Okay, good morning. I guess that despite the holiday, some Israelis showed up. I would like to essentially give you an overview of a work that I've been doing together with many other people in the last almost 10 years now. It is really an attempt to link information theory with the question of neural coding. It turns out to lead to some very general, I think, beautiful principles which are based on information theory, not only for data analysis, but also for maybe design principle, organization of neural systems. And I know that the focus here is on dynamics, but this will be really more of, if you want, semi-experimental talk. I'll be talking a lot about data analysis of and of course, with some theoretical ideas of how to address this data. And so, as you know, I'm from the Hebrew University, from the Center for Neural Computation there. And although I'm a physicist, I'm at the Institute for Computer Science there. And you'll see that a lot of what I'm going to say has to do with learning algorithms. So I'm actually going to trim down all the algorithmic part of the talk and talk really about the principles and the neural data part, which I think is more interesting for this audience. There are many people I have to thank on whose work this talk is based. First of all, foremost, Bill Bialik and Fernando Pereira, who have been with me on this journey since more or less 1990. And the many students who have been working with me, especially Noam Stoning, Gal Chechik, Camille Globelson. Neil Friedman is actually a faculty member who just recently jumped into this mess of information bottleneck and actually had a paper in the recent UAI in Seattle just 2 weeks ago on this, and I'm going to mention it later on. There's a big collaboration, sorry? UAI is Uncertainty in Artificial Intelligence, which is one of those computer science conferences, which is actually... Anyway, there's a big ongoing project, which are just almost finishing now, and the HFSP project, which has to do with the auditory system, from which I'm going to take several examples during the talk. And this is a joint project together with Austin, Ellen Elkin, and Eric Young, and myself, of course, and many people from John Hopkins and the Hebrew University and some from Germany. Anyway, the motivation is really quite ambitious. I mean, we know that information theory is essentially a theory of communication. And as Shannon himself put it later in his, after the big attacks that he was getting from especially linguists in the 50s, he came back from the idea that maybe information theory has anything to do with meaning, and focused mainly on the question of transmitting, communicating information in the quantitative sense of, you know, how many bits are sent. And essentially the question of meaningful information, or if you want, relevant information, was left out of information theory for many, many years. And so the real provocative question that I want to put up front is really, is there essentially in information theory a way of addressing relevance? And at least Bill and I think that there is. Actually, it's very much in there already. Just have to reveal it. And so I'll take you through some very basic definitions of information theory and try to convince you that essentially the notion of meaningful information is already there. It's just that due to some historical interesting consequences, this was left out, I think was considered something you're not supposed to do or touch for many, many years. I think that Noam Chomsky has a lot to do with it. Once I think we find some fundamental answer to this question, I think as physicists we all like, because it has a very simple formulation, what we can consider as relevant information, then of course the motivation that all of us had, especially Bill Bialik and me and others, is really, can we use it to address this basic question that we are all interested in, what is actually encoded by neurons in different levels of the information processing in the cortex and beyond the below the cortex, and I'm going to focus on here on the auditory system, where we really analyze cortical neural activity at different stages of the auditory pathway. And I'll give some examples from the fly neural data, of course, taken from Bialik and others, and from the motor system, maybe another one. So as you can see, we're really applying it on a very wide front to a lot of data, trying to understand if we can actually do something with it. So it's really more in the context of how to analyze responses of complex cortical cells, which are really very hard to guess what they're really doing. I mean, they're somewhere up there in the cortex responding to things which are obviously not trivial. And so as you can see, the principles that I'm going to lay out are going to lead to some sort of clustering algorithms, which eventually are going to tell us what are those components or features of the signal, of the stimulus, or if you want, of the response of the system, in the case of the motor system, for which those cells really care about. And of course, I also think about it as a general design principle, you know, very much in the spirit of Infomax, of Linsker and others, or other information theoretic optimization principles, which can or may lead to good understanding of how neural system can self-organize, or what is really pushing them to organize in a certain way. As you're going to see, it has a lot of the general flavor of statistical physics, and some sort of competition between order and disorder, which leads to some interesting structures. So this is the general motivation. And to make it a little more concrete, well, let's look at this very famous picture, I think, by now. This is data taken from the work of Rob De Ruyter and Bill Bialik and others at NEC or Princeton. I don't know where they are now.
Rockefeller,
yeah. Many other places. So it's actually part of a paper that we had together on the analysis of this fly data. So what you have here is a stimulus, which is really the velocity of an horizontal bar moving on a video screen in front of the fly, who is glued somewhere there in front of, forced to move this, to watch this movie. And here you see the spike terrains of different flies, different repetitions of the same spike terrains for the same stimulus, exactly the same movie. And the really intriguing question, we look at the responses across, of course, for the same fly, for different repetitions, and across flies, there's remarkable similarity, although there are, of course, differences. And
field,
right? Yeah, it's the velocity field, that's right. And of course, I'm sure you all know quite a lot about this data. So of course, the way that Bialik took this essentially is to treat it on first principles in terms of information theory, and really try to analyze this the signals as and some sort of an information channel. Something comes in, this is the response. We don't know much about the channel in the system theoretic view of the system. Let's try to estimate the entropy of both signals in principle, and then estimate the mutual information between the two, and try to see how much of, let's say, of the entropy of the spikes actually useful information in terms of the signal. And as you probably know, and Bill quantified this quite nicely, and it even came to the conclusion that the spikes carry certain number of bits about the signal per spike. There's relatively little noise, and they even claim that this is a very efficient channel in terms of the encoding of the moving. It's very close to the capacity. Now, this is a very special case, but it's a good system to study if you really want to work with very clean,
for the fly. What analysis you do per each fly independent?
Yeah, so of course we do it for each, not only for each fly, for each trial, each response separately in principle.
The number which you get, few spikes per few bits per spike,
It varies. Yeah, it varies, of course, across flies, and you see some flies have relatively low rate, and some flies have a very, very busy neurons. It turns out that the information per spike is very constant.
What do you mean? You have to make to calculate information because there are many, many petitions to calculate.
That's right, but
one trial.
No, you can do it for one trial because the stimulus is long enough. You have 1 hour of recording, more or less. And you can actually estimate in single trial all the statistics that you want, just because you're looking at a very, very low level statistic, essentially statistics of words which are made out of binary objects like this, where you essentially quantize, let's say every 2 milliseconds, you partition the spike train into bins of 2 millisecond size, and then you look at those binary words, whether there was a spike or there's no spike. And then you look at the statistics of those words, and these are those distributions that we, let's say, over 5 or more bins like this, and you can very easily estimate the distribution even on a single trial. There's enough data there.
Can you repeat the trial to get the conditional?
Well, this signal has a very stationary, well-known statistic. It's a Gaussian signal with some correlation and so on. So you can really estimate. You know everything you want about this signal. And you can really extract out the conditional entropy on the signal and the entropy, unconditional entropy, and then get the information. It's a relatively simple exercise. Of course, there's always problems of estimation and how do you do it in the limit and so on. But I don't want to get into it. I'm sure you all know about it. So essentially, there's some sort of a moving window that moves along the data, and we get those sequence of words. Essentially, it's a bitstream, if you want. And now we are already in the domain that information theory can deal with very easily. We have bits. The bits carry information about some other bits. I mean, even if you look at this signal not as a real valued signal, you can play the game that I've done and many others. Looking only at the sign of this velocity, and already most of the information is already there, the direction of the motion. And of course, you can play it, as I said, by estimating conditional entropies without really caring too much about the signal, as long as you know that you are conditioned on the same given preceding stimulus. Anyway, this I'm going to come back to this. This is just to set up the question. So essentially, what I'm really interested in is not how much information is there, which is a nice number, but it doesn't tell us too much. What I really want to answer is an entirely different question, which was left out of this framework of information theory. It is not how much information, but what in the stimulus is really important for the signal. What is the information, if you want, not how much. And this is one of those questions that you're not supposed to ask in information theory, because it has to do with this dangerous word meaning. Now, let me give you another example, which I'm going to elaborate on. So this is actually meant for people who know a lot about the visual system, as most of you, I'm sure. So the second path that I'm going to take here is really looking at the auditory system. And as you know, the auditory system is a lot less explored from various reasons, mainly because it was not as easy to record from, and because from some obvious reasons, the visual system is considered more important. But it actually has a lot to do with, I'm and many others are interested in the auditory system because I'm interested in language, I'm interested in speech, I'm interested in information processing in acoustic information processing for many, many years. Of course, there are people who are sharing this interest with me, like Ellie Nelkin and others who pushed me into this, or pulled me into this project. But it's important to realize that the auditory system is probably a lot more complicated than the visual system, at least at the level that we are looking at right now. So if you look really at the auditory cortex, in terms of synapses, you're talking about a much deeper level than, let's say, V1 in the visual system. So V1 in the visual system is probably something closer to the inferior colliculus or the IC, as we call it later on. And where if the retina or the photoreceptors are more or less analogous to the hair cells, which the first interface with the analog world around us in the cochlea. There are several stations of processing, all highly nonlinear, all essentially unknown in detail. And what we've been doing in this project is really have the same stimuli, which were designed or selected by Eli based on some other work that he was doing, some variations on bird songs, which we play to anesthetized cats. But that's
how frustrating. Your birds make
it. Well, it's very hard to record from awake kids. Almost impossible, especially because they're vocalized and they move. But it seems to not to make too much of a difference. And in these two labs, essentially in Jerusalem and in John Hopkins, we've been recording for different kids, several kids, on the same set of stimuli, which is something never done before, from different stations along this pathway. So especially we have cochlear nucleus, of course. This is mostly the work of Eric Young, who's been doing it for many years. And then we have IC, and we have this MGB, the medial ganglionate body, which is somewhere on the thalamus. Don't ask me too much about it. And then we have recording from the cortex, A1. And as you're going to see, I mean, the responses of these cells to the same stimuli is very different. So I'll try to take this as, I mean, the message is not really the auditory system, which I'm certainly not an expert on, but really how are we going to apply the same type of questions, this information theoretic questions, to somehow decipher or break the code of the system, of the various levels. Of course, we are not quite there yet, but also there's some nice preliminary results. So this is the type of stimulus that we're using for the auditory system. It's again taken from Eli Nelkin, of course. And this is a bird song. I wonder if you're going to play it to you. It sounds something like this. My mouse is crazy. Okay. If you want to hear it in, this is in somewhat shorter, longer duration. And sound like an owl. I mean, this is the general principle that if you slow down a small animal, it becomes a large animal. But
the one sound principle works.
Slow down the bird chip, it sounds like a cow. So, in principle, so this is a frequency versus time. This is classical spectrogram. And what you see here is really this very nice chirp, going up, going down frequency on a main lobe like this. And if you look at the firing rate on a very low level, let's say cochlear nucleus, really the first station, you see something which is quite well understood. I mean, you see this is firing rate for this cochlear nucleus cells, or very simple cells if you want. Some cortical cells actually also look like this. And they respond to up chips, more or less, maybe some down chip, but changes in frequency in certain domain, so some frequency range that these cells are responding to. This is a relatively simple, there's a filter just at the cochlea, which essentially respond to some variations in the energy through this filter and so on. This is relatively simple. Now what Eli found out, okay, so this is just supposed to illustrate this a little further. What Eli found out, and again, it's not the main talk of the, not even close to the main subject of my talk, I just want to illustrate how interesting this signal, these responses are, is that when you break this natural chirp into essentially three components, we see only two here, the main, which is really essentially only this main energy band of the chirp, which to you sounds more or less the same as the original one. I mean,
he just went in by, effectively went in by hand and put a bandpass filter in.
More or less, yeah. Trust him that he knows how to do it.
I just want to know what he did.
Yeah, that's what he did. Yeah, he just essentially filtered out the background. And then, so this is what we call the main part of the signal. And then you take this minus this, and you call this the background, and you see, or the noise. And the background is actually carries, as you can see in the spectrogram, quite a lot of the energy there, but it sounds very different. Well, actually, with this loudest speakers, you can hardly hear the difference. But this is essentially just eliminating what you may consider as the main component that should stimulate those cells. And it turns out that some cells really respond mostly, some cortical cells respond mostly to the background and not to the main, not at all to the main. This was, I think, a science paper 2 years ago. And
are you going to talk about this?
No. I'm just going to illustrate why is it.
He will come here.
No, I mean,
but Eli's coming. So Eli is definitely the right person to talk about.
No,
they're all the same cells, right?
Yeah, these are the same cells. Yeah. No, no, this is actually a simple cell. But so anyway, I'm giving you a very, this is Eli's talk. I just want to illustrate some of the interesting features of those. This essentially may be a summary of what we see at the different stations to this set, to certain set of stimuli like this. So this is again some sort of bird chips in spectrograms, and again you see the original and the main, more or less, and so here you have these two are cortical cells, these two are IC cells. The C's, and these two are LGB cells. And I'll come back later to what these histograms mean. This has to do with the analysis of data.
So C follows. So one is the original, one is the...
So this is the response of course, several repetitions of the signal to the rasters.
In A, that's four figures.
Yeah, this is the response to this one. It's a matrix of responses.
I mean, there is one, the origin, there is the filter, there is the noise, and what is the fourth one?
Yeah, so there's the background, the noise, the original, and there's also something which we call the artificial. It's really just a synthesis of the main, which you found. This is actually one of those, I think, quite amazing things that Eli found, that if you just synthesize a chip which looks exactly like this, just take a frequency chip with a design it with a computer or with a synthesizer, and play to the cat. The response is very different from, at least in the cortex, from the main part of the natural signal. That actually pushed him to study what is it in natural sounds that those cats are so sensitive to, which they can discriminate so clearly between natural and a very good synthesis of the main. But these are actually four columns because there are two different signals. This is one pair, another pair. We have a lot of this. I just want to summarize. The main information is here in the rasters. And the question that we are going to ask, actually, we have a recent paper which is not published yet. It's supposed to appear in the next NIPS. Actually talks about the redundancy and synergy among different cells at the different levels. Now, if we find in general that the lower level are a lot more redundant but carry a lot more information about the signal, but the higher level have lower redundancy and are a lot more specific. They can really tell you details. For the cortex, in some sense, is a very high level feature selector, which really may be analogous to phase cells in somewhere higher in the visual system.
Can I just ask, so when you talk about the background, Does it include harmonics of the main?
No. Yeah, it includes harmonics of the main, but the signal is not too harmonic. I mean, there is some harmonic somewhere there. This is 3 kilohertz, more or less, 4 kilohertz.
Yeah.
So the harmonics is 8 kilohertz, and it's essentially outside of the spectrogram here.
No, but
the background has some harmonics, yeah.
It's
very few.
The back one, you saw the harmonics.
Yeah, right.
Well, it's so warm.
Yeah, you see it.
Yeah, you can see that at 8 kilohertz.
But how do you know that there isn't?
Yeah, absolutely, you're right.
I mean, it's a fair question.
You actually hear it. I mean, you see here this harmonic and you...
The second harmonic might even be stronger than the first harmonic.
No, not in this case, but... And this is clearly stronger than this one, but...
No, I mean, sorry. three times the frequency might be stronger than twice the it's.
No, it's not. It's not true in this case. Okay, so since this is really not my data and not my point.
Isn't there this, you know, auditory illusion called the missing fundamental or something like this, where, you know?
We know in speech, of course, we don't hear the fundamental at all. Well, when fundamental, even in a telephone speech, for example, the few 300 hertz are missing, so the fundamental is not there,
so we still hear
very well. Of course, because there are 20 harmonics, and most of the information is not on the fundamental. It's very different here. This bird chip has relatively low and very weak harmonic structure. Of course, there are different birds. I mean, if you look at zebrafinch, for example, they have it's full of harmonics. It's very much like human speech. But this particular birds, I don't think the harmonics are very important. But anyway, the point is that I want to take those responses together with the stimulus and somehow discover the relationship between them at the different levels. And the question is really, how can we, okay, we see that those cells have a relatively reliable response, those less, maybe, I don't know. What does it actually tell us? I mean, why those have more or less an onset response? And in some sense, we are looking for, there's really a need for some systematic approach for dealing with the two ends of the system, with treating it as a black box, if you want, but still being able to say something about what are the features of the input that those cells really encode, and then ask questions about redundancy, synergy, and so on. So let me go back to information theory, and I'll give you a very low-level introduction to. So I apologize for those of you, of course, know it, but I think it's. I don't need more than that. So essentially, mutual information. I find it as a very fundamental quantity. I mean, we had, if you remember, 3 weeks ago. When was it? 2 weeks ago, we had a talk with Chaim Sampolinsky, who was. Also using mutual information, is claimed that for various reasons, mutual information is probably not the easiest quantity to deal with, and actually focused on things like Fisher information. There's something very fundamental about the definition of mutual information, which in a way I think makes it unique and the only thing to if you're really thinking about information, then in this, using the same argument that Shannon was using 50 years ago, I mean, what functions can measure information correctly? What they should obey, and by essentially two or three very simple axioms. And the main one is an additivity axiom. The information should be added for independent events. You get that up to a constant, this is the only reasonable function. But I want to think about information essentially, unlike entropy, which I'm sure all of you are familiar with, you can think about it as an entropy as, of course, this information theoretic entropy as the number. A number of binary questions, yes, no questions that you have to ask about a random variable in order to specify its value on the average. So this is the entropy of the random variable. And this is actually a useful way of defining it, because the next question is, of course, okay, so what are the questions that you have to ask in order to specify the variable? And we call this a code of the variable. Now, mutual information has a very similar definition, though it's never used in any book that I've seen. So of course it's a function of the joint distribution of two random variables. And I can think about it as the minimal number of yes-no questions, very much like entropy, or the minimal number of bits. Actually, I skipped a few transparencies here about entropy, but it's exactly the same definition. Entropy as the minimal number of yes-no questions you have to ask about a random variable in order to specify. Mutual information is the minimum number of yes-no questions that you need to ask about a random variable X in order to learn everything that X knows about Y. So this is kind of funny. But imagine that X and Y have something in common. I mean, they robbed the bank together or something. You don't really care about all the information that X has, the entropy effect, which has a lot of things that you don't care about, but only those things that he knows about Y, which are relevant in X with respect to Y. So just as you build a code for for a random variable, which essentially some sort of a partitioning of the random variable, ask, let's say, if the number is between 1 and 100 and you have to find it. So a good question is something like, is it larger than 50? And not, is it 50, of course, which is a very stupid question to ask, because the amount of information you could get by one is very close to one bit, and the other one is very close to 1/100, which is, I mean, it's much less than one bit. So good questions in that sense is something which I'm going to call a relevant code of X with respect to Y, is how, what should I ask about S in order to learn everything that X share with Y. Now, if you think about this, it's not as constructive. Actually, this definition is quite tricky because you have to take this minimum and on the average very carefully if you really want to turn it into an algorithm. But that's essentially what I would like to design here, is a code which I would like to call the relevant encoding of X. And so we know that mutual information is really essentially this number. It's the uncertainty about X when I know Y. And this gives me the famous expression that you're all familiar with, the entropy of X minus the conditional entropy of X given Y. This is, for example, the way that Bialik calculated the information in the spikes about the stimulus. And of course, it's completely symmetric. And but that's not good enough for me. I really want a way of constructing a code of X that will give me only the relevant component of X with respect to Y. So once we say it this way, it naturally defines this notion of a relevant code, which I find very surprisingly, essentially never treated this way. Well, there are many similar things by the information theory community. Of course, there's this famous Venn diagram. I think it's useful just to illustrate the relationship between those things. If you think about the entropy as the entropy of X as this bulb and this the entropy of Y, the remaining in Y given X is just this, of course, and therefore the mutual information is, of course, the intersection between them. And this gives you all these useful relations very easily, and I think it's a nice way to remember these things. Now, of course, if they don't share information, the mutual information is zero, and it's independent of how large the entropy of each of them is, of course. So relevant coding is, what are those questions that we need to ask about X in order to learn everything that X knows about Y? And in order to get those questions, we have to do something very similar to what done in usual coding. We have to partition the variable X into domains such that given, if I know at what component of X I am, I'll be able to know exactly what I want to know about Y and not more than that. So think about X and Y as taken values in some large spaces like this. Essentially, again, these are pictures which are familiar to people who looked at information theory. You know that if I specify the value of Y, the distribution of X is going to be modified. And essentially, I can think about it as given certain value, let's say of Y1, X is going to be constrained to some different distribution, which in some asymptotic sense, which I can make explicit here if you want, I can think about it as if the allowed X's are really constrained to a smaller domain. It's really not true once you talk about a single instance of X, but if you talk about long sequences, this is precisely what's going to happen. I mean, you're going to constrain the typical sequences of many X's to a smaller domain. So essentially, if I give you another Y, it's going to constrain the value of X in a different way. And the point of this relevant call is really to find the minimal, the coarser partition of X, such that if I know the value of X up to the component, I will be able to tell you everything that X has about Y in exactly the same way as if I had exactly the value of X. So I'm going to coarse grain X in the maximum possible way as long as the information about Y is preserved. So I don't know if you really got the idea. The idea is really, this picture is somewhat misleading because of this asymptotic notion, but if you really want to be rigorous.
Of redundancy in X.
Yes.
All they care about is y, so you reduce it by clustering.
That's right.
And then suppose you do it.
So you can think about it as clustering. I really don't want to emphasize it too much, but really the point is, of course, if every small change in x is going to give me slightly different information about y, then this has to be a very fine partitioning of x. But if only some coarse partitioning of x is enough, then of course you want to achieve this. And then in order to select this partition, you have to ask yourself, well, what is the minimal number of questions that I have to ask in order to identify the component in this partitioning? And this turns out to be exactly the mutual information.
So the questions will be just which cluster gets belongs.
I think I'm missing something here, but skipped too many slides. Okay. Yes.
I'm not totally sure I understand. Let's say x is a binary variable, 0 and 1.
Yes.
And it tells you one bit about y.
Well, in that case, y is just a function of x. Now, of course, if x and y are related in a trivial way, like, let's say...
So the question you'd ask x is x 0 or is x 1? And once you know the answer to that question, then you know everything x knows about y. Is that correct?
If y is a function of x, a one-to-one function of x.
No, so it's not one-to-one. Y has many elements.
Okay. So
basically, if x is there, partition to y one way,
right.
X is one, partition to y another way.
Right.
And the only things you can kind of ask about is x zero or is x one? That's the question you'd be asking.
So usually what you ask is not a question about a single instance of x, but about long sequences of many x's. And then, of course, you don't need this fine partitioning, or let's say the 2 to the n possibilities of a sequence of length n. You need much less than that, because many of them give you exactly the same value of y. And that's precisely what we're doing. We group together sequences of x such that they don't discriminate between the values of y. I'll get you an example in a second. I think we'll make
but
it a lot simpler.
I just want to follow through. So imagine you find this optimal partitioning of x, and then the questions which you have to ask about x will be which group they belong to.
That's right.
And then you say this will be irrelevant. So in what sense this is irrelevant?
This is an optimal way
of encoding.
The relevant information is only in that I throw away everything that I in x that is not important with respect to y.
So this would be
all the details of x which don't carry information about y are thrown away by this grouping, and only the thing that discriminate the y's are left.
The identity of these groups will be a meaning, some sort of meaning.
That's right. That's right. That's the point I'm trying to make. Okay. We'll see. I see that I'm getting a little too abstract here.
The probability of x given y1 vanishes everywhere outside the green circle, right?
Sorry, I missed this question.
You can only do this partitioning if the probability of x given, say, y1 vanishes everywhere.
Yeah, so that's what seems from this picture, but that's not true. I mean, if the probability of it's just a misleading. And I'm trying to illustrate it very simply. Of course, you throw away. I don't know if you ever seen the proof of the Shannon channel coding theorem, the second. So it has a very similar picture. They have the values, all the values of the inputs, all the values of the outputs, and then given the input, there's a channel which actually blows it up. And then we're talking about typical sequences, very long sequences, conditioned on one value of y. And of course, the distribution is slightly tilted. But once you talk about long sequences, you're essentially going to eliminate almost all sequences except a very small portion of them. And that's what I mean by this bold here. It's actually an asymptotic argument. I'm willing to go through it with you. At this point, I just want to make a very intuitive. Now, the notion of relevant encoding is actually very old in neural networks, where people were essentially training. Training neural network auto associators in a very standard way. I've seen it really in the 80s and the tons of papers of this nature, which are essentially looking at relations between two variables x and y, input and output relationship, and trying to essentially constrain the hidden layer or the intermediate layer in such that it's a lot simpler, let's say in terms of the number of hidden units or anything like this than the original input dimension. And by doing this, by essentially reducing the dimensionality of the hidden layer, you're essentially forcing the information to move through some sort of a simpler representation. And by doing this, they actually claim, I mean, many people, Hinton, for example, and others, that by pushing this to be the smallest possible while still preserving the mapping between X and Y, this hidden layer, which I call here X hat, is going to capture the relevant part of X about Y. So you really don't have enough representation space, if you want, to really capture every detail of X, but you force, using, let's say, backpropagation, you force Y, the mapping between X and Y, still to remain as close as possible to the original relationship. And in this case, the hidden layer is going to extract, if you want, the relevant components of X. So, and they call it internal representation, or useful representation of the data. But this is something which was used in the all this auto associators. I mean, something you do it on X itself. I mean, you're trying to predict X from X and through a small dimensional hidden representation like this, and find really what is it that important about X. If X is actually very simple, maybe it can be compressed to a low dimensional representation. Now, what I'm going to take this type of picture very seriously and use information theory directly in order to extract this type of representations. And of course, you can do it on various, what X and Y can be many different things, like the past and future of a signal, and in this case X hat will be some sort of an efficient predictors, or it can be two samples taken from the same population, and then I'm actually asking an entirely different question, which is known in statistics as the two sample problem, which is really what is in common to two samples. It's going to be some sort of representation of the parameters of the system, and so on. So, and actually each one of those examples can be taken very seriously, and we are taking it very seriously, to generate a different type of learning rule. And here you already see that this question of what is relevant in one variable about another is such a fundamental question that essentially is behind many different questions like noise filtering, prediction, feature extraction, of course clustering in the general sense, and so on. They're all essentially different simple cases of this larger question. So here is a simple example which will illustrate, before I go to the neural data, I think illustrate the idea very clearly. So imagine that I have a collection of documents. Actually, this is almost a real example. It's not a real example, but we are doing it for real data as well. Collections of many, many documents, and we look at the statistics of words in these documents. So in this case, we just look at the first order statistics, how many times the word, let's say, Israel appeared in each document, or how many times the word doctor, and so on. And so each one of those matrices is essentially it's a co-occurrence matrix, the number of words, statistics of words in a document, and this is a joint, you can think about it as a joint distribution of documents versus words. And if you look at such matrices, you always find out that if you do some permutation, there are actually very clear clusters of documents, classes of documents, which have similar conditional word statistics. And once you do this, you immediately realize that these three documents have probably something to do with Israel, and these four documents have something to do with health and doctors, and so on. And the natural thing to do is to compress the document variable into clusters if all you care about is information about the words. And actually, this exact system, which is based on clustering of documents based on the statistics of words, is a very useful technique that we are using, including commercially, and for some companies who are doing, let's say, email classification or things like this, document categorization, and exactly the same, based on exactly the same principles. So now you can say, okay, I don't really need to discriminate the documents completely in order to keep the statistics of words, and of course, symmetrically, I don't really need to discriminate the words. I can cluster those words into one category, which is, you could call health, I don't know, and this document into DOS or computers or whatever, and And so there is a compression of this joint co-occurrence matrix, which really preserves the mutual information between the two variables.
So words that have multiple meanings would lie off diagonal, or you don't get them rarely enough so that they don't matter? I mean, in any words that have multiple
sure.
meanings, it would lie in multiple clusters.
Sure, sure, sure. Of course, by doing this, I'm talking about, of course, health and doctor are not synonyms.
Right.
Actually, there are no synonyms in real languages. I mean, there are only approximate synonyms. There are synonyms in a certain context. And in the context of this collection of documents, this seemed to be enough to discriminate. Now, of course, you're right. You can find that actually this matrix is not as uniform as I think, and there's some small differences here, which actually discriminate health from doctors. And therefore, this cluster should probably be refined if I want to be more precise. But there's some kind of a hierarchy of coarse graining of the document or the words partitioning that preserve information to some extent. And exactly how much is something I want to focus on in a second. I just want to illustrate the idea. I think it's a very simple example that everyone understands. And of course, what you do here is you cluster the documents into word clusters. And by doing this, you immediately discover that there's some structure in the documents that were given to you. Actually, what we did here is we took some large database of 20,000 documents taken from news groups over the web, and by this technique we essentially discovered the news group and were able to say, oh, it's coming from, and of course somebody had to tell us this is politics and this is health and this is golf and so on. Yes?
Okay, so I'm still confused with this question. If one of the words had been lead, L-E-A-D,
yes,
then that could have been under politics or it could have been under metals.
Absolutely.
So if you had that word in that column, then half of its values would be in one cluster and half of its values would be in another cluster.
That's right.
So how would you choose which cluster to put it in, or would you just...
So essentially the way we are going to do it is we don't do hard partitioning. What we do is assign essentially a probability of a word being in a cluster. And that's exactly what's going to come out of the algorithm. And if the word has really two meanings, we're going to see that its weight is split between different partitions. Actually, we're going to do a lot more than that, if you just allow me to get there.
Are the documents standardized for size?
And the words? Well, the documents here were actually documents or messages.
Let's say different numbers of words.
Yeah, there are different sizes. Of course, we normalize it in various ways. You can take a look at my webpage. There are about 20 papers on just this subject of document categorization and classification based on method. I just want to really bring you the idea in a very simple way. So essentially, the document clusters, in this case, preserve the relevant information with respect to the first order statistics of the words. I don't really need to care about the exact identity of the document, but only where does it come from. Is it health, or is it computers, or whatever. And as I said, so essentially what happens here is that we took these documents and word statistics, and we compressed the documents into clusters of documents by essentially throwing a lot of the original structure. So we took, 20,000 words in different words, which were in these 20,000 documents, something like this, maybe less, and we compressed them into, let's say, 20 clusters. So essentially partitioned the document space into 20 categories, such that the information between the clusters and the documents and the words was very close to the original information. So let's just do a little more careful analysis. What is it that we actually need to optimize here? So if you look at this X space, essentially what I'm looking is a map, which is going to be in general stochastic. That's what I said. I mean, we're assigning probabilities to each document. So I'm looking into a stochastic map from the original space, think about it as document space, into clusters of documents, which I call here as X hat. And what I'm missing here, what I'm looking for, is a probability, a conditional probability, how X is mapped into X hat, and such in such a way that the partitioning that I get out of X is going to be optimal. Optimal in what sense? So again, I wanted to minimize the number of binary questions that I want to ask. And if I ask myself, what is this number of question? Of course, what you have to do is to divide the volume of X, which is to some extent the exponent of the entropy of X, actually exactly this, but I'm missing this N here, which, not to confuse things, but maybe it does confuse. So the volume of X is 2 to the entropy of X. The typical volume of this partitioning is exactly what we call 2 to the conditional entropy of X given X hat.
This is the number of clusters.
This is the volume of each cluster.
The volume.
Yeah, it's 2 to the condition entropy. Again, I'm doing something which some mathematicians are not happy about because I'm averaging in the exponent, but of course you know that that's the way it should be done. And then the number of partitions is simply the ratio between these two, which is precisely the exponent of the mutual information between the two. So what I really want to minimize, and the reason I give this slide is because what I'm going to say next, immediately people jump on me and say, why don't you want to minimize the entropy of this thing? I really want to minimize the number of questions that I have to ask about X. And this number of questions is precisely the log base 2 of the number of components that I get here, which is precisely the mutual information. So the whole goal of this slide is to mention that mutual information is the right thing to optimize. And if I didn't, if you're not convinced, please stop me. So again, this is what I just said. And here is the way I want to deal with this relevant compression question. So now we have two variables, X and Y. They share information. They share information, meaning the meaning of this is, of course, that they are not independent. If they are not independent, the mutual information between them is positive. And another way of thinking about it, that if I specify the value of X, the conditional distribution of Y is going to be changed, which I just denote here by this slightly confusing picture. It's not going to be constrained to some subset only, but only asymptotically, but it's going to be changed. And of course, this is, if the conditional distribution of any of them and the average is going to be changed, then there is mutual information. It's the same thing. But now I want to compress X into those relevant components, this relevant encoding of X, X hat, such that, I wonder how far I can stand, such that the, again, the reconstruction, the partitioning of X through this unknown conditional distribution px hat given x is, and of course the distribution of x hat itself, these are unknown here, but that's of course not enough. I mean, you can always compress x in an arbitrary way, you have to constrain this. So this is the compression part. I want to minimize the mutual information between x hat and x, which is again minimizing this number of yes no questions in my coding.
Short.
Yes. I'm sorry.
Short.
I actually read
short
it.
Encoding.
Yeah, short, I mean a small number of yes-no questions, or small number of bits. Yeah, okay, well, it's not the best wording maybe, but what I mean here is really that the number of components here is going to be as small as possible, which, as I just showed you, is really minimizing the mutual information between these two things. But that's, of course, not enough. You want to preserve the information about Y, so you know that each one of those partitions are going to be able to predict Y, and if I do it right, I will be able to compress X precisely such that Y will be predicted in exactly the same way as if I knew the original X. And once you see this picture, you have the whole setup, all the components of the problem are in front of you. There's this mutual information of X and Y, which I assume that I somehow know, or essentially I assume that I know the joint distribution of them. But what I'm looking for is a compact representation of X, which will capture everything about Y. So I want to minimize this subject to a constraint on this. And once you realize this, the rest is just algebra. I mean, so you have a very simple variation of formulation of the problem. And actually, the reason I draw this graph is because later on we're going to generalize it in a very dramatic way into multivariables and very complicated graphs. But at this point, what I want is to, on one hand, reduce the dimensionality of X by minimizing this, what I call IE, the representation information, and at the same time I want to maximize or to preserve the output information, the predicted information, and you have a very simple Lagrangian, put a Lagrange multiplier, which we call here beta to the minus 1, for a reason which will be clear in a second, and I want to minimize this under a constraint on this. And of course the variables that I'm going to play with are the representation as well as the marginal of x hat, which is a function of this, and the mapping from x hat to y.
So, question?
Yes.
The first step looks like a standard source coding problem, is that correct?
Absolutely. The first part, so for those of you who know something about lossy compression, or rate distortion theory, I don't know how many of you have heard about it. So that's what I mean when I said that actually information theory has really the components of the answer, what is meaningful information. So you know that the first part of information theory is how you compress a variable without losing anything, so what they call lossless compression. So you take a long sequence, let's say text, and you write compress, and you get a shorter sequence. And what does it do? Essentially, if you're lucky, you get shorter sequences, and essentially reduce the redundancy. So if the parts of the text that repeat themselves, like different words or different sentences and so on, that repeat many times, you don't really need to put all of them there. All you need to do is to put them once and then give you the indices of where the other parts appear. This is more or less the way Lempel-Ziv algorithm and things like this are working. So essentially, you just reduce repetitions, reduce redundancies. And by this, you compress without losing anything. And you know that the limit for this compression is precisely the entropy. Now, this is still, meaning has nothing to do with it. This is just pure compression. This is called lossless compression. Now, there's another very intriguing notion in information theory, which is called lossy compression, or compression with distortion. And there you're saying, okay, I don't really want to preserve all the information in my original signal. It's because not everything is important. I want to preserve only things up to certain distortion. Let's say you're talking about encoding of speech, and you're using cellular telephone, and of course you don't really care that every bit in the original speech stream is preserved, but only what those things that you more or less hear. So that's precisely the idea of speech encoding, which is a lossy compression. You compress the signal such that only the audible, the relevant component of the speech is preserved. And the way you do it is you say, okay, I go to an acoustic engineer, and he will tell me how to measure how well I can distinguish between different codings. And you design some sort of a loss function or a distortion function. And then I minimize the information, which is, again, the number of bits that I'm actually going to transmit over the line. This is what I pay money for. And I want to minimize these subject to the level of distortion that I'm willing to tolerate. And by doing this, you can compress a lot less than the entropy, while still preserving only what they consider relevant, which is what we can distinguish. Now, this is precisely the same idea, so if you recognize this part of the story, it's exactly the same as lossy compression. You compress this part of the signal such that something is preserved, but instead of preserving the distortion, I'm preserving the information about another variable. So as I said, this is essentially a very little twist on this very old idea. I mean, the rate distortion theory has been with us since 1960, more or less, although many people are not familiar with it outside of the engineering community because it was not part of the original paper of Shannon in 48. It actually only posed the question there, but interestingly enough, the question was really answered by Kolmogorov in 1956 or something like this, and then Shannon independently proved it in 1960. And it's still, I think, largely unknown. Yes?
Part of what the X-hat is encoding is the question. I mean, given the documents, you could ask a different question, which is sort them according to author or sort them according to the language they're written into.
Sure.
Sure. You have had different X-hats. So
no, it'll have actually different Ys.
So you have the same, I thought Y was the collection of documents.
Of words. No, X was the collection of documents in this case, and Y was the words. But let me give you a slightly different example which will illustrate. Imagine that I want to compress speech. Now, I can compress speech in various ways. I can care about the content. Let's say I want to do speech recognition. So all I care about is to keep the words well discriminated. This will give me one sort of compression. But I can also care only about, let's say, the identity of the speaker. which is an entirely different question about the speech. And the identity of the speaker will require entirely different compression. I mean, I don't care about that. I want to preserve exactly those things which carry information about the speaker. Now, in these cases, the compression of the two signals will be very different. One of them will preserve the information about words, but will maybe eliminate completely the identity of the speaker, so I can forget about the pitch and the pitch variations, all these things which are speaker-dependent. But care only about this generic type of speech. This is a very lousy compression, by the way, but it can be done. This is what you care, let's say, in military situations. And in other cases, you really care about the identity and not what he's saying.
Yes, my question was, there is a piece of information which is, what is it about? Where is that information?
In the why. The why is telling me what is it that I care about.
So by how you clustered X, you can somehow be able to abstract.
That's right. I cluster X precisely such that Y can be reconstructed.
Okay.
You just make a decision ahead of time about what you care about. Right?
That's right.
Right. For the
now, in this neural data, which I want to come to in a minute, that's precisely what we do. I mean, we have the stimulus and we have the spike trains. I want to compress the stimulus such that the spike train can be reconstructed. Okay? And that's what I want to call the relevant encoding of the data. So, okay, so all this long detour is just to bring you to the fact that there is a nice mathematical formulation here which has the flavor of an information optimization. So it's a trade-off between two informations, how much you compress and how much you preserve. So it has this nice competition between compression and, if you want, energy and entropy, or order and disorder. And so it's going to give us some non-trivial solutions. And it turns out that you can actually do this precisely, take the derivatives with respect to those variables, and get equations that have to be satisfied together. So all these things have to be satisfied together for this optimization of this variational problem to be stationary, if you want. And these three are essentially trivial. I mean, this must be obeyed, of course, just for consistency of probabilities. This must be obeyed because I assume X hat is a function, is depending only on X, so there's a Markov chain here. So the dependence of Y on X hat must be through X, which is exactly what's written here. It also comes out of the taking the derivatives. And the non-trivial part is really that if you take this Lagrangian and take the derivative with respect to the unknown mapping to X hat, you get something which I found very nice, because we actually guessed it ahead of time. This is what we should do. That the optimal map must be exponential in some quantity, which is very familiar to those of you who did something with information theory. It's exponential in the cross entropy, or the Kullback-Leibel divergence between two distributions. So this DKL is a positive or non-negative quantity, which is telling you essentially how similar the original distribution of Y, conditional distribution of Y on X, is to the predicted, if you want, distribution of Y given X hat. So this plays the role of a distortion function here. It's not something we assumed in the game. It comes out of this variational problem, and it's a very nice quantity. It has those it's positive. It's, of course, not symmetric. It shouldn't be symmetric. And it in this case, since PY over X hat is always an average, if you look at the previous page, it's always an average of true distributions like this, a weighted average with those weights. These two are, this is always bounded, and it doesn't suffer from all the bad things that Chaim told you about 3 weeks ago. But, and actually it is related to many other interesting information theoretic measures like optimal classification and so on. But essentially, the game that we are playing here now is the following. I mean, we can predict Y from X directly using the original distribution, or we can first compress it using this mapping and then predict Y through this Y given X hat. And what we are asking is that these two predictions will be as close as possible, which is precisely minimizing the scale divergence. So it has a very simple intuitive meaning. Notice, by the way, that these two equations are highly nonlinear. I mean,
exactly, you now said
so I want to find a self-consistent solution of those equations.
I'm minimizing L,
which is I'm minimizing the number of yes/no questions subject to the information they want to preserve.
It
turns out to be equivalent to minimizing an average KL divergence. It's completely equivalent, and of course it's not surprising. Information mission information can be written as an average
what are your free parameters that you have to minimize on?
The values of those distributions. I don't know what this is, and I don't know what this is, and I don't know what this is.
But just you have to define how big the space is.
I'm looking, I'm actually taking, at least in the general setup, you don't assume anything about those distributions except that they are probability distribution. They're normalized to one, and they are positive. X hat is not assumed. Nothing is assumed about X hat. It's a very good question.
It's a free parameter.
It's not really a parameter. It's a label that I assign to those partitions.
Dimensionality of it.
Okay. It's not set here. It's something I have to choose. I mean, you're right.
Yeah.
But you'll see in a minute how.
No, I'm asking if you choose it and fix it, or you...
No, I actually optimize over it, and I'll show you. There's this parameter beta, this Lagrange multiplier, which is going to determine the trade-off between these two informations, and this is the one which is going to select the number of clusters, or the size of the partitioning for me. Essentially, what is the kind of trade-off that I'm going to do, how much information I want to preserve versus how much information I want to compress, or to throw away. And this is going to determine the optimal number.
So at the output of the subprimitive, you have to get another dimension of the space of X.
Among other things. I'm going to get a lot more than this as time allows me.
This is the solution, but you don't see here how deep.
No. So this, I just want to emphasize that these are coupled equations which somehow have to be satisfied simultaneously. And since Px given X hat is related to Px hat given X through Bayes formula, these two things are coupled together. Actually, all three equations are coupled together, and they're coupled in a funny way. I mean, this py given x hat appears here, and
not a real solution.
This is an implicit solution.
Okay, so you still have to find z.
Yeah, that's right. This is an implicit solution which I have somehow to iterate, or to find. And of course, what happens is that you have to. It turns out that you can solve it just by iteration, and as I said, I'm not going to emphasize the algorithms here, but there is a very nice algorithm which is known in information theory as the Blaut-Arimoto algorithm, which we generalize here. Essentially, you have to find three unknown distributions, and by iterating those equations, you can prove convergence, and you get the solution just by starting somewhere and iterating those three equations.
So
yes?
Something there must make the size of x hat want to be smaller than the size of x.
Yes, absolutely.
So what
it's this parameter beta. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Let me maybe. So this is again the algorithm, just for physicists.
Can you look at the same question?
One question. What is the kind of function z?
Z is just a normalization, a partition function. Z is just the thing that makes this normalized to 1 over x hat. And of course, it's a function of x in general, and this parameter beta, which appears in the exponent in exactly the way I want it, as an inverse temperature-like parameter. And as you can see here, if beta is very small, this means that I don't really care much about the differences between the clusters and the two distribution. So the whole thing is going to be the number of partitions is going to be small, or I'm going to have very coarse partitioning. If beta goes to infinity, T goes to zero limit, I'm going to be very sensitive to differences, and therefore, in order to preserve it, I will have to increase the number of clusters, the number of components. So beta is the parameter which is going to play the role of regulation or regulatory parameter in this game.
This is Lagrange
multiplier. It's the Lagrange, it's also the Lagrange multiplier.
So consistently at the end, it's not the free parameter. The free parameter is how much information you want to preserve.
Yes, that's right. They're related to each other.
Okay.
But of course, as usual, you don't work with the energy directly, but with the temperature. It's much easier.
So
and just here, you fix beta, and then you see how much information is preserved. There are, of course, Lagrange multipliers that are related. One determines the other. Not quite. You'll see in a second that there is some subtlety here.
Can you prove that it's a global minimum?
No, I can't prove that it's unique. Actually, I can prove it's not unique in general, unfortunately. This is each one of those components is uniquely determined. It's a convex function. But when you take the difference between them, you get very nasty things, as you can imagine. I mean, unfortunately, this is it's much better than you can imagine let's say, optimizing quadratic functions for various reasons, but it's not unique. It's not a single... because I can encode very difficult problems here. So if this was a unique solution, it has a unique solution, I could actually show you that I have a polynomial algorithm, some MP Hall problems, which is probably not what I want to do.
No, so, what you want to do with
it. We'd be grateful.
No, for a while I thought that maybe we are lucky. Then I realized I can easily map into this some general clustering problems, which are known to be hard. So probably not what you want. And actually, there are obvious symmetries here, permutation symmetries over the clusters, which have exactly essentially the same solution. But beyond this, there are many other redundancies.
You may want to demonstrate, or you can choose one.
I don't know. I'm already speaking for more than an hour. Let me just finish this algorithmic part, and then after the break I'll talk about the data. So as I said, there is a general algorithm which we call the information bottleneck algorithm, and two of my students have been working on it quite extensively, Noam Slonim and Amir and Gal to some extent, and several others, and we have really very nice results both about convergence and proofs and relations to other things that I don't want to get into here. I just want to, just one piece of, if you want, statistical physics here. It turns out that this algorithm is really minimizing something like the free energy, which is the log of this partition function, which is really the fundamental component here, which has exactly the shape of information plus distortion times some Lagrange multiplier, and each of those iterations is really reducing this function. That's how we prove convergence. And the whole thing can be done very efficiently using all sorts of computer tricks that I don't want to get into. So
the average with respect to PY?
So it's average with respect to this PX and Y, I mean, the data that you have. And just one last bit before the break. That's again, for those of you who know something about rate distortion theory, which is more or less an empty set here, so there's something very important in rate distortion theory. In rate distortion theory, remember what we want is to compress the variable. You want to minimize this I, which is the number of bits we transmit, I x x set. It's the number of bits we actually transmit, subject to an average distortion of the signal. And what turns out to be the case is that there is always a function, which is known as the rate distortion function, R of D, which tells you that above this function, with zero distortion, this is the distortion, the average distortion, and this is the number of bits you transmit, or the rate of the code. And if without distortion, you just get that the limit of the rate is the entropy. But if you allow distortion, you can compress much better than the entropy, or send lower, less bits. So if I give you this level of distortion that I'm willing to tolerate, there's a minimum number, which is the lowest possible rate that you are willing to tolerate at this distortion. So above this line, there are codes that can achieve it for you. But this above the line is achievable, and below the line is not achievable. So this is, in some sense, is a generalized Shannon limit. Of course, when you allow a very high distortion at some point, you can transmit at zero rate, which means if the distortion is unbounded, I can just send you nothing. So it always goes to zero at some point. Now, so this function is a very important function. It's called the rate distortion function. It's really generalizing Shannon entropy, and it tells you how much structure is this in the problem, how much loss you are willing to tolerate at a given value of distortion. And it turns out to characterize the problem in some sense. So speech, for example, has one rate distortion function on the average, which really characterizes the complexity of speech. Of course, with respect to a given distortion function, that's a crucial point. Now, it turns out that we have here something very similar, actually identical to some extent, which Bill and I call the information curve. It turns out to confuse a lot of people. You can look now at the ratio between how much you were able to compress the signal. So the reason it's confusing, because now this variable moves here, but it's really the compression level. So how much I was able to of course, the maximum possible, from the maximum I is the entropy of X, where X hat is just X. So I XX is just HX, and this number is bounded by 1. And then I can compare it to how much I can preserve the information about Y. So of course, for the Markov condition of the data processing inequality, I know that this information, IX hat Y, is always smaller than the original information, so this is also less than 1. And the question is, okay, given this joint distribution, what is the best maximum number of information that you can preserve, the maximum ratio, at a given compression level? It turns out that there's also one function which is independent of any algorithm or anything, which is always convex, or concave, I don't know how to say, like this, such that, just the opposite of what I drew there, here you are allowed, you are able to compress, so there is a code that will achieve this level of preserving of information, let's say 50%, at this level of compression, but not beyond that. So it's really a phase diagram, if you want. This in these two parameters, here you are able to compress, here you are unable to compress. And what's going to be interesting is to look at real data and to see how those curves really look for certain codes. It really tells you something about the complexity of the problem. Very complex, very simple problem, a very simple coding will have a very steep curve. So I can compress very much the signal and still achieve very high of the original relevant information. So if it goes, let's say, over very, very few clusters, a very, very small number of bits here, to very high ratio of the original information, then I call the problem simple. Complex data, let's say like natural language or things like this, tend to have something which is very, very close to the diagonal. So essentially, you give me a little more bits and I give you a little more information. There's no simple structure that captures everything. So I think I'll stop here and go back to the data and show you how these things really look for the acoustic data and some other neural data. So there's just one point I want to say about this figure before we continue. It's very simple to see from the original variational principle that the slope of this curve is exactly 1 over the Lagrange multiplier, simply because we take the variation of the combination of the two to 0. So on the optimal solution, just like, you know, the slope between energy and entropy is the temperature, this is precisely what happens here, and which actually enables us to take beta as a parameter that moves us.
It doesn't look like a constant slope.
It's not a constant slope. That's the point. I mean, for a given value of beta, you are on a different place on this curve. So when you start with a very, let's start here with a very low, very. This is better than minus 1. So here we have slope 0, which means a very high temperature. This is really the limit of no information. Essentially, no compression, I mean, which means that all the information is preserved, and you have a slope 0. And when you get to this point, this is the trivial point where essentially no information is preserved. Here is all the information preserved. No information is preserved. Of course, you can compress then completely to one point. But the slope here is infinite. So by changing beta from, let's say, 0 here and slowly increase it, it's just like annealing the system. You decrease temperature. And so there's a very natural algorithm which comes out of it immediately, which is some sort of a deterministic annealing algorithm where you increase beta slowly and follow the solutions by changing beta. So
that's how you compute.
This is how we compute the number of clusters, and the next picture is really how it looks for this document data. So what you see here, there are too many things on this graph. First of all, this blue curve is the result of a different algorithm which actually starts from this side. We put each document in a different cluster and then combine them. It's a merging algorithm. Which is turned out to be a lot more practical for various reasons, a lot easier to do. But these red lines are really those annealing curves for different number of clusters, for different sizes of partitions. So here you see that they all start along this envelope curve, which is really the optimal rate distortion function or information curve. So there's some sort of an envelope here. But when you restrict the number of partitions or the number of clusters, let's say to 2, at some point you can't stay on the optimal curve. This is a real curve calculated for real data. And there is a phase transition, essentially, which keeps you on a lower number of clusters. And this is the best you can do with 2. Now, if you stay with 5, let's say, you keep this optimal curve up to a higher point, and then there is a transition that takes you to the best you can do is 5, and so on. So actually, there is a cascade of lines like this, depending on the number of partitions that you allow in your data. But so
the curve that you drew was...
So the curve was really the optimum, the best you can achieve with any number of clusters.
So it means that the number of clusters would be like a parameter.
So beta and the number of clusters are related, but in a non-trivial way.
Okay.
So up to a certain beta, any number of clusters above 2 is going to do just as well as 2. Up to a certain other beta, this beta critical 5, if you want, any number of clusters above 5 will do just the same as 5, and so on. So they split in different places on this curve, and identifying those phase transitions is actually a tricky, numerically, it's actually a tricky thing. So that's why the merging, the agglomerative algorithm is actually working, it's easier to handle, and that's what we actually use in many cases. But
clearly not working because it's lower than the blue curve is lower than
the hard partition is always worse than the soft partition. So this line is a hard partitioning of the data. It just merged documents in this case, and this is actually quite surprising that you can do better by softening the partition of the data by introducing this, as you just said about ambiguous words. If you force a word to be in one meaning, you lose information. And if you keep it ambiguous, you actually gain information. That's why the soft partition is better than...
So the continuous line and the dash?
So essentially what we did here is essentially by merging, we got, let's say, to 100 or to 20 clusters. And there are actually interesting reasons for these jumps here, but I'm not going to get into it. And then we started to solve these self-consistent equations and move and actually decrease beta, or if you want, warming up the system. And then we got this nice red curves, but the information curve, the optimal one, is something that goes here. And you see, this is actually typical to linguistic data. It has relatively high complexity. Well, no, not that high. I mean, actually, you can get something like 90% of the original information with something like 20 clusters or more. Let me go back to the fly data and show you how this looks for this data there. I mean, so essentially, again, I'm going to run through it unless you stop me. What we did here is, this is relatively recent, we took those distribution of binary words of spikes in the fly, if you remember, and we really tried to see how much we really have to compress in order to identify the original signal. So it's again a compression of essentially try to find clusters of binary words, of spikes. It's actually the opposite of what I said before, such that the information about the original stimulus is preserved. And we see something quite interesting. It's almost a universal curve among flies.
Is the spike trend?
So X is the spike trend, right?
And
Y is the stimulus, how much we can preserve the identity and time of the stimulus. And unlike the thing, I mean, you probably know that Bialik analyzed with several people this problem for many years, and actually this is such a simple system that everything is understood, and you know that exactly what is encoded is correlation of velocities.
You posed the problem at the beginning was to understand.
You're right.
What is in the signal the neurons care about?
That's right.
Now you say what is the signal?
There are these dual problems all the time here. Essentially, what you really want is to compress both of them. You really want the minimal. Okay, I agree. I'm a little confusing here. Here we really look at the distribution of words for a given stimulus, and then try to compress it. We actually played the other game as well, but this looks like a little more interesting.
But then what's the question
I'm actually trying to see if I can you can really look. It's really the code in the following sense. You really want to see what combination of spikes are really important for the system. Okay. Again, this is just an illustration. I mean, this was done mainly by Al Schneidman in the last few months. And what I find intriguing is, first of all, those information curves for the flies look quite universal. Actually, there were three flies there, fly one and fly two, which has relatively similar rates. And you see that the information curves, it's not really information curve, it's the information versus the number of, preserved information versus the number of clusters. Is related, is almost identical. And a fly three was a fly that had a firing rate about an order of magnitude lower. And you see that this fly has slightly lower information per cluster. And it actually looks, so this is essentially how it looks for this fly data. So you see that you preserve about 60% of the information with only three clusters. It's quite amazing.
How long the words are?
So it's five bit word, I think.
But it depends on the word length, right?
It does depend on the word length actually quite quickly. Actually, we have methods which I don't want to get into to eliminate this dependence completely. We can work with variable length word.
So we're looking at
word length, yeah.
What do the graphs represent?
So those are the histograms. This is the probability of a word among those, actually no, I think this is seven bits. Yeah, it's 128. It's a seven bit word. So there are 128 configuration of spikes in 7 bits, and these are the distribution of those words in a cluster. So now we're actually compressing the words so that the information about the stimulus is preserved. And you see that what I find intriguing here is that when you look at five clusters,
so you just press them somehow. You label.
Yeah, so you actually look at the stimulus that precedes a certain word in this among, of course, most of these words have too many spikes to appear at all, but
clusters of words. Okay.
And these are clusters of words for two different flies, and you see that they're actually remarkably similar. I don't know, maybe not, but. These are the five clusters that you get for clustering one fly versus another fly, and you see at least some correspondence. I mean, so this is obviously a trivial cluster. This is zero.
The setter cluster is just one word.
The setter cluster is just no spikes.
No spikes. Okay.
Yeah, but the others are, I don't know. They have some general similar shapes. And it's more than the number of spikes.
How did you label your words according to?
So we partitioned them according to the number of ones. So if you see these blue lines here, this is 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 spikes per word. And inside doesn't really matter. But the reason we show it this way is to show you that it's not only the number of spikes that counts. Actually, the structure inside the word also matters. And you see here, for example.
It looks like the number of spikes is
the main thing. The number of spikes is the main thing, but it's not the only thing. There's information beyond that. So, for example, you see that here there are spikes, or here. I mean, this cluster is some combination of 1 and 2. And this cluster is some combination of 2 and 3, and so on. It's not.
Maybe redividing it would be even better.
I'm not saying it's a very striking. Okay, well, the take-home message from here is that. Of course, there is some structure. We know from the work of Bialik that there is structure in the timing of the spikes. And you see this here in a slightly different way, that there is some entropy left in the correlations between the spikes. But what I find intriguing is this smallest universality of the information curve.
These structures overlap?
These two, the green and blue, really overlap.
The upper curve, some words are two different structures. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, it's of course there's 128 combinations, of course, so the first two bits can be in this one bit can be in seven different places.
No, but one 7-bit binary word looks like can be in more than one cluster. Is that correct?
Green, so it's
soft partition?
Yeah, it's a soft partition anyway, but I'm not sure you're right, because as far as I know this was done by a hard partitioning algorithm.
But if you look at the vertical line, things can be in more than one zone.
If you look at this vertical line.
Yeah.
Especially the one with zero splits.
Yeah, yeah. So, first of all, in principle, it's a soft partition, so this is possible, but I know that this work was actually done with the hard partitioning algorithm, so I'm a little puzzled by this, but I'm not sure I know the answer to this. I'll check it. But the other thing is really to look at something also that very similar to what Bialik has done in the past. He actually looked at it as a linear system with as a filter. Like what you see here are the stimulus, this velocity stimulus that precedes each of the words, and here you see the stimulus just before one of those five clusters. You see they're slightly different, and if you compare them across flies for the first two clusters, I find it quite remarkable that they have, across different flies, very similar shape. This is more or less the type of filter that that Bialik always claimed that actually reconstruct the signal in this case. But actually it turns out that if you don't only look at the spike trigger average of the stimulus as he was doing, but really at the cluster trigger average, you get much finer discrimination, and one can actually try to give some meaning to those different curves. This looks like some sort of derivative of the signal. So you look at the velocity field that precedes each of those words.
You had up to.
I have 128 words in principle. Of course, a lot less than that in reality.
No, but on the previous slide, you had up to 1,000 clusters. So you just.
Here?
You just took it when it had a small number.
That's right. Of course, we're talking about the first five here. This point.
Okay.
This is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
And then you average whatever was before plus number 1.
That's right. That's right.
So, I mean, this is the real essence of what your result is.
That's right.
This is the special.
This is the essence.
How can you get with 128 clusters smaller? Clusters refer to longer words?
Yeah, if you have only 128 words, how can you have 1,000 clusters?
No, I mean, in principle, you could. I have to ask a lot. But I think he went here to 4,000. If I read it correctly, which is something like 16 bits. But, it's less than that, it's 14, 12 bits. But in principle, this is part of a work which you can get. We actually measured words in variable lengths using a different algorithm, which I want to get into. And we had words which could be very long, certainly beyond 10 bits. So I guess here we are talking about, this is
very long words. So
very long words. Yeah. But it turns out that this is really what I wanted to remember. So unlike this filter, which is more or less what...
It's another problem. You have very long words, but the signal changes very quickly. So what sense does it make to wait until the word is completed and then ask what it tells about the future? If during
this is the beginning of the word. So it goes in positive time,
right.
And this is millisecond before the beginning.
I understand, but you have to wait until the word is completed to see what the word is.
That's right.
So if it's a long word, it means that you have to wait.
Well, it's not. I'm not talking about a real-time process. I mean, we look at the sequences.
No, I understand, but if you don't do it online, but still just.
So you may ask, why does the fly care about what happened 100 milliseconds before the spike, the first spike? I don't know.
Misha, this is the same question. Anytime you have a filter and you reconstruct it, there's stuff in the past and stuff in the future. And either you put in by hand the fact that it's causal and you cut part of it off, which somehow is never mentioned in the papers when people do it, or you just say that there's a delay. And in the case of
the way Bialik does filtering is that you have each spike and add some template. But you don't have to wait for many spikes. Every time there is a spike, you add the template.
That's layer reconstruction.
But here you have to wait until the word is completed,
and then
define and determine which cluster it belongs to, and then go back and say, that's what we learned about this.
No, but it's not different than
what's done in the past. This was done in the past also.
You take a whole data set and make the optimal filter. That's what the fly knows, and you're
I mean, that's the same philosophy that's done here. You're averaging after the plan.
No,
but the word itself is long. The word itself, which gives you information, not one
second. Yeah, that's right. It's about
a very long sequence.
It's about 20 to 30 milliseconds. Yeah.
And, sounds like a very long.
But if you look again at the, I mean, because we had a student.
Misha, are you worried about the trust understanding of the message?
I'm worried that this word should be influenced by what happens now and not what happens before the word began.
But even on the.
What do you mean now? There's no now.
Wait for, let's say you take a word of 50 milliseconds. See what spike happened or not happened.
It's actually less than that, less than 20 in most cases.
Whatever, right? And then this tells you about what was the signal before the word began.
That's right.
But it seems
so you would like to shift it.
Influence about what happens right now.
No.
You see that it's not. What? I mean, that's if this was the case, I should have got something flat here.
That's what you were looking for. But
I think you're being unfair to Paul, because in fact, if you look at the fly, right? I mean, you lose predictability for components above 30 hertz. I mean, that's both in Rob's data and who's the student? Who's the student?
Ramon.
What?
Ramon, what? Is
not Ramon, experiment, but what is it?
Everin.
I mean, Everin reproduced this in a student lab with ours. I mean, you don't have information above 30 hertz. You might as well wait 30 milliseconds into the past is the same as being now. And
That's right.
Fair.
Anyway, you're saying I was talking about 100 milliseconds. Of course, here you are right. There's really nothing here. It's not.
No, I was not worried about.
But this part is certainly not trivial.
The future.
The future?
No, yeah, the about itself, because you're saying this.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I mean, there's probably something to look at after zero.
So you would claim that
what I claim that this is a finer resolution picture of what you usually see in Bill's work.
But you would also go to an experimentalist and you would say somewhere between the photoreceptor and the stupid H1 cell in the lobular plate that maybe there are filters that look like this.
That's right. That's precisely what I said.
That's the strong statement.
That's right. And they look
nice.
Quite different. Yeah. I mean, actually, you know, so we looked across flies, and I didn't expect to see anything across flies. And the first one seemed very much, very, very uniform across flies. The other one, okay, maybe.
But Mishra's worry if the signal is non-stationary and message followed with a different message and so on. How long time you have to wait for next message to average? This is a question.
So. Actually, we played with this. I don't have the data here, but we played with this offset here. And I think this was the best we could get, I mean, in terms of separation of the two different clusters. But you're right, it's a valid question and should be tested.
Let me ask you something. Let's say you average not for negative times, but for positive.
Yes, I just said it. I mean, so we actually played with the offset here.
Okay.
And they moved it, and you get something which doesn't look as. It seems that really the large magnitude of the filter is really there at the first 20, maybe 40 milliseconds, before the beginning of the spike. It's absolutely valid and legitimate to look at what happened later on.
Okay.
I don't have this data here. We definitely can do it, and maybe did it.
But
ask a large Schneidman or his other person how exactly he did it. I don't want to get into things that I.
Okay.
Details that I don't know, but okay, let me just this is just to give you the big picture. So we did the same thing for the acoustic data, and actually this is a long story and you're going to hear this. We have at least one paper on this at NIPS, the coming NIPS, but you can get all of these from my web page, for example, and this is the same picture I showed you before. And now you can, of course, do the spike-triggered spectrogram. There's a very crucial issue of quantization when you talk about data like acoustic data. And before you actually start estimating mutual information, you need to quantize the signal, unless you have some good analytical model of the signal, which you don't.
Sorry.
Yes?
Before you go on, I mean, if you're going to play this game with somebody else's data, you've got to complete the story. I mean, so suppose you take your first five filters, and then you did something like trying to reconstruct the velocity from this.
Yes, well, we do better reconstruction.
I mean, you have, I mean, obviously.
No, of course, no.
Okay, the question is, I mean, just to give a flavor, there should be self-consistency. You should do a reconstruction and then go back to your mutual information plot.
That's right.
Is it self-consistent?
It's self-consistent. So you see that, for example, the picture is more or less clear here. The difference between 4 and 5 clusters is something like a few percent in information. Between 2 and 3 is quite dramatic. So if you work with only one filter, you're going to lose, let's say, something like 10, 15, 20% of information compared to, let's say, 5. And in this case, it means that your reconstruction quality is lower. I can actually turn it exactly into distortion.
No, I mean you're losing 50% of the information between 1 and 5.
Yeah, something like this. Between here, this is, forget this, here or here somewhere. This is this fly. There's some discrepancy here, but let's say 50% of the information is here and about 70-80% here. This is how much you gain in and you can translate it into distortion on the original and the reconstruction. I don't have it here, but that's absolutely a valid question.
So in principle, you should have two curves. Like one is usual dialect reconstruction based on single splines.
That's right. And actually, this is true.
One which is based on growth, and this one should be closer to the data. Something.
That's right. I mean, it's a general message. I mean, you do a spike trigger average. You usually mix different passes. We see it even more in the auditory system.
Sure.
And by this, we simply separate them, and we discover that this spike may come from very different sources. Different types of stimuli can cause the spikes depending on what happened in the neighborhood. And this is just a way of splitting this up to the different filters, if you want, the different components that trigger this spike, especially when you talk about high level. In the auditory system, it's a lot more striking.
I'm sorry for being so pedantic. I
mean, yeah.
You basically see the same curves for different flies. That's what you should.
Yes. This is the same. This fly has an order of magnitude.
The same filters.
It's very similar filters. I don't know. This is the data. It's you see, this is for 3 different flies, and it looks almost the same. I mean, this is biology. You don't expect much more.
Open door and the bottom. What are the differences?
So this is one. This is the first cluster. This is the second cluster. In terms of weight.
And 3 flies.
3 different flies, yeah.
And the clusters for all the flies are the same clusters?
Yeah. So these are the clusters for 2 flies, but you can... I just wanted to show that they're more or less similar. I mean, there's a very clear correspondence between them.
So the curves there are different?
This is the average, the spike trigger, the cluster trigger average, if you want, for the first... for this one and this one.
No, I mean the next curve. So the cluster for different flyers are different, a little bit different clusters.
They are very different clusters. They are different, but you see that the filter is similar to, I don't know. This is not very compelling, but this one is. Yeah. And of course, it's, I don't know, I think one can do a better job here, but there are not much simpler systems than this one.
And you didn't push this in ways that, I mean, this was kind of a demonstration issue for your method. You didn't push this in ways to go to low light condition where you thought the system may slow down.
No, but we should. It's taken from a NIPS submission that was rejected from NIPS recently.
Rejected?
This particular paper, I mean, we had others that got in, the acoustic data. So NIPS is...
Congratulations.
Are you trying to reject your data? What's going on? Seriously?
Okay. This was rejected, I don't know. We sent 4 papers to NIPS, 2 got in, 2 got left out. It's very simple. I can understand that they're fed up with this type of... Anyway, when we talk about the acoustic... I won't be able to say much about it, I just...
Yeah, but I have a question.
Yeah.
So, Dalek had this filter for 1 spike. He derived it without any information theory.
No, of course, the information theory. I mean, calculated this information and was trying to... But it's not... It didn't use the information theory to actually...
Yeah.
Quantify his results using information.
Which optimally reconstructs.
That's right. That's right. It's a linear reconstruction. Reconstruction.
And you can do the same trick with instead of taking 1 spike, you could take words of different.
That's right.
And so you come up with a filter.
That's right.
Which will be optimal in terms of estimating. How this relates to what you did?
It's very similar. The only thing is that I quantify those filters based on the level, the amount of information I'm able to.
The same filters.
They're very similar filters. Those things are very similar
to what
you see in the spike book.
No. I'm saying now, suppose you do what he did, but not with spikes, but with the words.
Yes, he actually did it also.
Instead of taking 1 spike, then 20 milliseconds, take all possible words, treat them as events, and do a filtering with them.
So you see, first of all, that this That's exactly what we did here. The signal conditional distribution on the word is redundant. I mean, so you can group those words together.
Okay, so you say this is just doing the, making this possible.
That's right. Well, you can
because
do it.
Otherwise, you would have to do all possible combinations. Yeah.
Well, you can do it in many different ways, but the message is that you can compress those signals without losing information. That's right. Although the reconstruction part is not done. So, the similar idea can be done with the acoustic data. You can do this spike trigger spectrogram. Of course, looking at the preceding acoustic signal, this is this bird chip, and try to average them. And of course, you discover immediately that when you look at the cortical cells, that some of those spikes come from very different reasons. I mean, they respond either to wideband or to an upgoing chirp or something like this. And here is just a slide. This actually got into NIPS. This is a slide taken again done by Gal. I just want to flesh some results here. It's obviously it deserves more attention. But so this is those components. It's actually complicated. So what you have here are those cluster triggered spectrograms. Not spike, but cluster this time, for the same cell. But now we are looking at the different levels. Remember that the whole point was here to compare the processing at different stations in the acoustic pathway. And you see the number of cells. All right, it's going to take me a little more than this. So you have the IC is the blue, the MGB is this one, and the cortex in the red one. The point is, of course, that first of all, to show that there is a lot less information about the stimulus in the higher level, okay, as a function of the number of cells you record. But at the same time, we were able to show, and it's not in this picture, that the redundancy is decreasing when you go higher in the auditory pathway. So there is more information about the spikes, so in some sense, the lower stations. IC, for example, is directly has a very nice filter that corresponds to the data directly, but the cortex has a lot less redundancy. So different cells are telling you different things about the stimulus.
Is it simultaneously or it's different?
Well, it's obviously not simultaneously. Nobody can record simultaneously from the cortex and IC, and it's not even the same cat.
The cortex, this is the adjustable.
No, unfortunately, Ellie is able to record maybe from two cells, two or three. No, so this number of cells is across different repetitions of the point is this it's actually even across cats, okay. The point is that you it's actually a very consistent picture. I mean, those error bars should be taken seriously.
So you assume that these cells are independent.
Yes. But the stimulus is the same. That's how we can compare them.
So you go one by one, but then.
I shouldn't have brought it. It's a separate talk. But I just want to show you one kind of result that you get from this analysis, and this is this measure of redundancy.
Which you had enough data in cortex to compute information from 15 cells.
Yes. After you do quantization of the signal to very few. So we do vector quantization of the signal first, to very few, some like 16 or 32 vectors. And then you calculate on this reduced matrix the user information. You're right, it's an issue. We were trying to be very careful here, actually estimating error bars on the user information. I think we did it right. But I think it's the first study of this kind that actually show you, give you a direct hint of how much information is processed by each cell in different levels of this acoustic pathway. And we can show you a lot more that this is another paper that you can get from my webpage on redundancy and synergy in the acoustic pathway, I think.
Is there a relationship between this work and Heinz's work about the relationship between mutual information and the number of cells and the asymptotic behavior that you talked about? Is there any relationship?
Yeah, so he's talking, this is the low information limit.
He's talking about zero, what do you mean?
This is the low information limit. I mean, you're talking about very small number. That's why it's more or less linear. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. It eventually should saturate somewhere because the signal has a log number of quantizers. I think I'll skip this. This is too much. I just wanted to show you the information curve here, which is, again, something interesting. one thing, just that about 80% of information can be captured by something like 5 clusters. So it's a very, this is not quoted.
This is a, but there's a number of, if you started removing neurons.
Yes.
There's a number, is this dependent on the number of cells that you have, and the number of splices you have, the number of clusters?
The number of clusters certainly depend on the resolution that I have on the spikes. And
no. So it's an experiment. This is just a statement about the data analysis, not a statement about that.
No, it is a statement about how much of the information, how much you really need to know about the, what is the type of resolution that you need to preserve about the spikes in order to capture. For this particular, of course, it's a mixture of the experiments and the data, but and the system. But for this resolution of stimuli, this is the number of combination of spikes that you need to keep in order to get most of the information.
Is it the resolution of the stimulus, or is it how many cells you record from? I started adding another cell and another cell and another cell.
So another cell will give you higher resolution in one of those variables. I mean, you have more bits in the words. And then you, of course, we actually play this game we play this game by looking at multiple cells as binary bits, so it's small windows. The more cell is another factor of 2 on the number of, another cell is another factor of 2 on the number of configurations, and or more, depending on the width in the time. But what we are saying is that to discriminate those signals, and this is discrimination with respect to only those 4 signals, background, main, you need very, very few clusters. I mean, very, very few combinations of words. I don't want to stress it too much at this point. Let me just say another set of data which we are working on, and this is data taken from Elon Vadia on a motor task where you have this bimanual and actually simultaneous recording from the two hemispheres of bimanual motion. Where essentially the point was really to try to distinguish 4 types of motion as a function of direction, where you have a unimanual motion either left or right, or bimanual where you have parallel or anti-parallel or opposite directions motion of the hands. And again, the data requires a lot more than I'm just giving it. But we made some quantization of the acoustics of the spike trains based on another technique which some of you have heard me talking about in HMM. And so in this case, we did something very different. We look at simultaneous recording of many cells and quantize the activity independent of the signal first using an hidden Markov model. And then we have a quantization of both the motion and the multicellular activity, and that now we are able of measuring mutual information, and this is the upshot of what we get. So again, so the first step is quantization, which was done using hidden Markov model. In this case, I don't want to talk about it. It's again some sort of quantization of multicellular activity, but the point is that now you get this matrix of spike patterns versus motion, and by rearranging this matrix, just as we did with the words and documents, you get very nice clusters, which is just a permutation of this, and the which means that those cells these patterns more or less have the same response in terms of the HMM states, but never mind that. This has slightly different, so on. So those 5 categories are enough to get a very nice separation of the activity. So this is a distribution of words, in this case, of state of the HMM. And these are the corresponding statistics of the motion in a polar diagram. So this is direction versus velocity. Direction, velocity of the two hands. The red and green are the right and left hands. And you get something which I find quite nice for such a simple analysis, that there are clusters, let's say this one, that clearly indicate opposite motion. I mean, this pattern of activity appears only when the right hand is moving in one direction and the left hand in the other direction. And this one, this is more or less indifferent, but there are cases where, like this one, where the right hand is indifferent and it this cluster is sensitive only to the left-hand motion, and so on. So this is the type of analysis that you get by looking again at cortical activity together with the movement and then quantize both of them, and you discover that from this type of recording, this is the type of separation of the motion itself that you can get.
How many are each of these words in the model?
How many spikes? So this is actually quite a lot. I mean, you have here.
I guess how long is each state?
This is a five-state AGMM,
which... And how long is your state time?
And the duration, this is what this picture is supposed to show you. This is the duration in time around the motion, and you see here over different repetitions of the experiment, of the motion, and you see here the dominant state at each time in the AGMM. So this is a partitioning of the data into states, passing the data into states, into this five-state AGMM, going into this state, and you can see exactly the answer to your question. I mean, so here it is a few hundred milliseconds and so on.
But I mean, on the previous slide, the interesting state was the one that split up the...
Yeah, this is one that it's very easy to interpret. There are many...
Let's go back, right? That's five. And five is red.
No, it's not five. Okay, this is... the way the quantization of the spikes was done.
No, but I'm looking for the red state. Isn't the red state the one that's, according to the next picture, that's split up?
No, it's not one of the states.
With cluster 5, is there a state that shows up on the previous data that has to do with cluster 5? Is there an epoch of time in which that's the HMM state?
I'm confusing, I'm afraid. There's no direct relationship between this picture and this one. Just principles should be clear. We have a way of quantizing the spike train into words, which are the states of an AGMM. Here there are only five states. We can actually, and here it was done slightly differently, and there are a lot more combinations. But let's say that these are directly spike combinations. Okay, and now those are the corresponding quantizations of the motion that preserve the information about the activity. And it turns out that you can really identify things like opposite movement, only left, only right, which are these two, which are more or less symmetric, and then indifference of two types, which I have to... This is more or less horizontal motion, this is more or less vertical motion. And the fact is that they all correspond to a mixture of patterns of spikes, which are those histograms. Now, I'm confusing you because the number of clusters here is exactly the same as the number of states. It has nothing to do with each other in the HMM. The number of clusters is the result of this bottleneck algorithm. The HMM is just a way of quantizing the data. It's just like, when you do speech quantization, you have, first of all, to take this continuous signal and quantize it into some sort of discrete variable so that you can start measuring joint distributions or estimating joint distributions. The same must be done here. So the number of spike patterns is way too large to really work with the spike directly.
So instead of words that are made up of zeros and ones, you're using words that are made up of
zeros,
ones, twos, threes, and fours.
That's right. It's actually more than one cell. In both cases, we have three or four cells in each hemisphere. It's a lot more complicated data, and I didn't want to get into it. Again, this information curve is quite dramatic. I mean, you get essentially 80% of information with something like three or four clusters, in this case, about the type of motion that we talk about.
Why do you choose five states instead of just longer words than the other two states? I mean, the number of letters in the word can be traded for just longer words with fewer letters. I mean, why did you base this on five? Why did you base your words on five states instead of two?
There was obviously a confusion here. This is exactly it's a separate thing. I just want to emphasize that there is an issue: how do you quantize multicellular data? I have, in this case, order 10 cells recorded from two different hemispheres, and. It's obviously a lot too large of a space to actually directly take the spikes pattern as we did before. So we need some method which is able to capture the complexity of this data by throwing away information into something else. And now, there is a method that we talked about in the past, which is, again, based on analogy with speech, which is using hidden Markov models to do discretization. I don't want to talk about it too much here. And unfortunately, this particular agent we use here is not the one which was used simply didn't have the right picture for this analysis. Here, something else was using, you can see that the number 180 appears here. This is direction, and this is activity. But anyway.
Go back to galaxy, which is easier for
Is this the last? Is there another?
Let's finish. This is the last data slice that I have here. But now I can, of course, do the following. Either talk about more details about the data analysis, which I'm afraid I won't be able to satisfy you completely, or to show you some extensions of this idea. Let's just overview some theoretical. Where is this taking us now, and why do I think that this is a very general principle for understanding many other mechanisms?
So can I ask a question first?
Yes.
So let's go back to the fly data. Let's say you want to cluster the stimulus rather than the spikes.
Yes.
So in that case, you start in the infinite dimensional space of time series, right? And, I mean, you have to. You can reduce that to a finite dimensional space, but you have to quantize, or you can work in, say, continuous space and do the clustering.
That's right. So the way it is done here is, this is also. Bialik is, of course, involved in it, and it's done exactly the same way that they did it in the past. So remember that we have many different repetitions of the stimulus at the same time. So here you have those windows, and the signal was the same signal. So you have you can easily estimate the probability distribution of the words at a given time. Okay? So even without knowing anything about the stimulus, which is of course a continuous signal, and in order to quantize this you need to invoke some sort of a distortion measure on the signal, which I don't want to, but you have many, many different repetitions of the same signal. So now, I'm talking about hundreds of repetitions. So now you can look at those probability distribution of words given time as your entry to the matrix. And quantize time, essentially.
Right, right. Then you cluster those words,
that's right,
for similarities and maybe
that's right,
filter or whatever. But
that's right.
Once you have the clusters, you can then work from there.
So we look for times that have similar distribution of words, of binary words. We avoid the issue of quantizing the signal. Okay.
So that means you have to sample your space pretty well.
That's right. You can do it for a very few systems. Of course, you can't use the same trick for anything like cortex or in mammals. Because the system is not as reliable.
I want to understand exactly what you did. So X here is the words of spikes of some length. So you determine how many milliseconds you need to allocate. So these are your X, all possible words. And what is Y? Take all signal or also break it into pieces.
So no, we just talked about it. So why is really a piece of segments of the data?
Of
a certain length, 100 milliseconds, whatever.
Okay.
Now, of course, you are sliding this window across the data and you have a lot of statistics.
But you determine
the point is that, okay, I move every 2 milliseconds or something. Okay. Now, the point is the point in this experiment that there's 1 hour or more of recording, and the signal repeats itself many, many different times, right? I have this fly sitting there for 30 hours.
The signal repeats itself.
No, if you take this 1 hour and repeat it 30 times.
You take 1 hour and repeat it. So the experiment lasts for 30
for days.
Hours.
Yeah, something like this, order of days. Now, so you get a lot of statistics, which allows you to estimate this probability distribution, the probability of a given word, which is our spike configuration, at a given time.
So you mean so much data because it's like taking a high order correlation considering spike.
That's right.
That's the simple idea.
That's right. You can take, of course, a higher order. No, the point here is that you don't want to deal with the quantization. I'm not sure I'm answering your question, but So you take those words and just count how many times each word appeared at each time, and now you have this huge matrix of times goes over thousands, just like the documents. And for each time you have a statistics of words. Now you can compress the times.
Total, I'm trying to look at your algorithm and see exactly what corresponds to what.
So yeah, you're right. It's confusing because in different setups,
so
different things go.
Conditional probabilities of y given x, for example. So this is the conditional probability of having a particular spike configuration after a particular segment of the sequence. We take into account the timing also.
Yeah, I mean, you see, in order to avoid dealing with the quantization here, we just treat times as different documents. So each time has a statistics of words, just like each document has a statistics of words. Now we collapse all the times into that have the same statistics. And you get very few clusters that preserve the information about the time. So in a sense, I did exactly what I said I'm going to do. We collapse the pieces of the stimulus at different times such that the information about the activity is preserved. What is confusing here is that in order to compress time, to compress the signal, you look at the statistics of spikes. So to compress the spikes, you need...
Before something else, you explained exactly the curves which you had, or you are now talking about something different?
No, this is what I had. I'm sorry, I was... saying something which was somewhat confusing, maybe even wrong. This is the experiment. I mean, we take the word distribution at given at different times. So this is a big matrix of size, let's say 4,000 configurations of words of bits.
Why 4,000?
Because we have 12 bits. Okay.
After
12 bits. 12 bits. And this is the maximum number here.
Okay.
Or here it's 64, I think. Whatever. This is 64. And it's always a power of 2, of course. And you have, for each time, a slightly different histogram.
And time beginning from the onset.
And time is an absolute time here, because the signal repeats itself. Always beginning from 0, where you start the experiment.
Okay?
Now, you have many repetitions of the signal.
Okay.
And now, essentially, once you have those distributions as a function of time, you can forget about the signal and just treat these rows as just as I treated different documents. And now you compress the times.
So it's like information about the time.
Information, it's about time. That's right. That's right. But of course, this time is distinguished only because of the signal.
Because you repeat it. So
that's right. That's right. So this, I think, it's a little more. How many slices?
Spikes.
Total number of spikes? What do you mean?
I'm just trying to get a feeling for the chance of doing this.
You need the. This can be done only for such data. This particular simple setup.
But such data is how many spikes?
This is order of 1 million or more spikes.
Okay.
Count it. I'm talking about 30 hours of 10 hertz. Okay.
So the fly doesn't go to sleep or
something? No, the fly doesn't go to sleep. No, he's getting... he's slowly dying. But
it's not the situation is not very, let's say, stationary.
Well, it is. Can't trust Rob that the measurements are coming from stationary flight.
300,000.
It's more than that. Yeah, well, okay. I said order of million, I think this is, because it's not 10 hertz, but slightly more. But that's what...
So, I mean, but then it gets back to, suppose you just take a... there's one thing to say, in the laboratory, this is a great way to make, you know, a set of filters, a set of words that the fly likes to see, but your claim is that this isn't something that normally you won't adapt to, because you need too many spikes. How do you envision
this direct way of doing it? Cannot be done for anything more other than the fly, as far as I know. I mean, really quantizing times directly, because you never have this ideal setup. So in general, and that's why I was trying to show some more complicated data, but obviously I didn't succeed. You need some other ways of quantizing the spike and the stimulus. and in order to start estimating mutual information.
I'm trying to ask you something. One might guess that biologically these filters adapt to the spike trend. It's hard to envision adaptive, right? So many spikes.
Here's so many spikes for you too.
So.
No, but what can I measure?
I know very little. I think
that measure from a monkey for 30 hours.
Yeah, but in general, the number of unknown unknown control variables in the monkey are so the data is so much more complex. There is very little chance to really do the same. In this case, you essentially control almost everything. There is adaptation, and I know that Bill is working on it with other people. The question of adaptation to the filters, but we don't see it here.
Is the delusion or is it real that there's some pattern around 3.3 seconds on those rasters?
So you see that something happens here?
No, 3.3
and 3.4.
3.3 and 3.4. There's something curve that goes.
I don't think there is any real structure in time here.
No, it's right.
Maybe.
So that may be some kind of adaptation.
Some sort of fatigue, yeah. I don't know. I mean, assuming that this is really the right order in time, which I'm not sure. No, I don't know. Maybe. I mean, this is just a snapshot of the data. There's a lot more than that.
Yeah.
But you want me to interpret this little curvature here?
Yeah.
I can't.
So, I mean, just to bring this back, a couple of weeks ago, Chuck gave a talk, Chuck Stevens. And, I mean, he measured the field potentials of Manhattan in the hippocampus or an animal running around the maze. And then he played that back as an interesting of occurrence into the cell. And the cell did something funky in time and had a very complicated temporal response. And there was this vague idea that somehow the cell is looking for some as a filter. And you would argue, I mean, that this might be the something. That I should take myself.
That's right.
And it clearly depends on many spikes because you have adaptation and effects. And
right, he was talking about slices, no?
Adaptation effects.
No. I don't think that the analogy with his talk is that straightforward, but.
No, because you're saying the only way to get these filters that depend on multiple spikes is if you have some strongly nonlinear process.
That's right.
Which is.
No, but not only nonlinear, I mean.
Effect.
Yeah, that's right. The facilitation, shunting, whatever. You have some changes. In the auditory case, we see it very clearly. The same cell respond to very different things, like upgoing chirp and then wide background noise. I don't know. And completely unrelated, if you average them together, you don't see anything. Or you see very little. And if you separate the two, you see that actually there are two different mechanisms which are involved here. That's essentially there. Just like those filters. Anyway, I'm always in trouble when I'm asked to give the details of
but as an experimental issue,
things that I didn't do myself.
Identify five states, but you could be happy identifying even two states, one more than you would get from just a simple linear model. Right. I mean, do you have a sense what you need in the data?
In order to work with, so whenever if a simple linear model works and you explain everything, as is almost the case here, then fine. I mean, you don't need it. But what I claim is that for almost all neural recording of this type, where you have some higher level recording and some very complicated stimuli, there's no chance that a linear system will do anything. And then you need somehow to break the system using mechanisms of unsupervised learning into subcomponents. Each one of them might be linear or might be have a simple underlying structure. And this is the way we propose to do this separation in time. So essentially, you just separate the different possible mechanisms that trigger this cell by just dividing them into similar statistics of the stimuli. That's all. It's actually a very simple idea. Now, I want to sum up somehow because I'm really getting way beyond my time. So I just want to stress a few theoretical points which I simply don't have time to even start talking about.
I mean, Colin, couldn't you do this in a single cell, in a slice, have a white noise stimulus coming in, looking at the spiking output of the cell, and then the things you should back out should be things that look like...
It depends on the activity you don't see. It's some sort of a hidden activity of the rest of the slice. Yeah, absolutely.
Not the rest of the slice, just that cell. Because, I mean, the cell has calcium dynamics, it has a memory, it has facilitation, it has a memory, it has synaptic depletion. I mean, these are all facts, and you should then back out things that you could then re-express in terms of biophysics.
Yeah. So if you treat one cell as such a complicated creature, which you should, of course, this is some sort of...
Try to bridge this abstract idea with something that you can make a very definitive model of that cell and then get this out from a calculation of that complex cell.
Of course, with single cells, we all hope that we can use some more solid models to really write down the dynamics and understand the different phases of activity. This is made for black box type of, you know, reverse engineering type of...
A solid model and you do this kind of thing, and you may see, you can understand better the single cell.
No, that's precisely the message. I mean, use this, this is a reverse engineering, an inverse system method. I mean, you have input-output trying to reconstruct the system using... And of course, if you know something about the system, use it and work with the two things together. That's the kind of message I'm trying to give you now. But yes, in principle, this is taken from, you know, machine learning. I mean, you really want to treat the systems as black boxes and trying to somehow factor out the different components of the code. And then, of course, the hard part is left out. I mean, how do you interpret those clusters as some mechanism that you can understand? Anyway. I simply feel that I'm exhausted. I don't know how about you, but so I just want to somehow. So essentially, I claim that there is a really general, common information theoretic principle behind many different problems, and I just listed some of them that I think can be mapped directly into this information trade-off between compression and compression on one hand and preserving the information on the other hand. And it's actually fascinating to study each one of those things separately, and we do it in various contexts. In particular, it's a good way to deal with neural codes. And I just gave you some illustration, obviously not enough to convince you that you can do more with this type of approach on data analysis. And the rest is in many different papers that you can get from the web.